Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we sure did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the fabulous Dar Williams singing along with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Rivertown Kids, with the Grammy winning Tomorrow's Children album, the Solartopia song. We're back for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show. We got a good show with two of the great stalwarts of the safe energy movement for the last decades. Paul Gunter will be joining us from Beyond Nuclear. And right now we have Kevin Camps on the phone. Kevin, you with us?
Hey, Harvey. Yes, I am.
How are you doing, man? Where are
I'm
you?
I'm good.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Washington.
Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, where they're about to rename the professional football team, we hope. And Kevin, you're right with Beyond Nuclear. Tell us a bit about yourself before we jump in and get to the nitty-gritty of our nuclear issues for the day.
Well, Beyond Nuclear is a national watchdog group on the nuclear power industry, and I myself have been in D.C. for 15 years, but hail from Kalamazoo, Michigan, so I kind of get back to the Midwest a lot on a lot of the dangerous reactors back there.
All right, and you actually heard me speak back in our mutual youth in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're a Michigan boy. Are you from Kalamazoo?
Yes, I am a Kalamazooan in addition to being a Michigander.
A Kalamazooan.
That's
we
right.
Like it. Okay, I have to, since you brought that up, I have to say that I've been reading a book called 1491 about America before Columbus came, and there is a long discussion about Amazonians, including the myth or the legend of Amazonian women who were warriors, and it was actually testified to by a Roman Catholic priest who was in the Amazon, said there was a tribe of women. They grabbed men whenever they needed to have to reproduce, and then the line was that the men they grabbed, they went in boys and they came out old men. So I don't know if that's true about Kalamazooans, but you were pretty good in your recent days, and you're doing great work. So
thanks,
let's
Harvey.
Start talking. You have been to Japan since Fukushima, is that correct?
It was actually before. I was there 7 months before the catastrophe, and my first stop after Tokyo was Fukushima Daiichi. I did a series of meetings with local elected officials, one of whom at the time was pro-nuclear. And since then, he's the mayor of Futaba, one of the host towns, is one of the leading anti-nuclear voices in Japan. And then I did a community meeting in the evening. Probably 75 people showed up. And the thing that's so upsetting, I guess, is that all of the people I met during the course of 2 or 3 days there are now nuclear refugees.
Wow. Tell us about what is a nuclear refugee?
Well, there is a 12.4-mile zone that was drawn arbitrarily by the Japanese government. It should be much bigger. And all of the people from that 12.4-mile radius have been removed from their homes. And so they are officially evacuees. They call themselves refugees, and they can't go home. So we're talking something like 150,000 people. And that's just the official number. The zone should be much bigger. In fact, the U.S. government itself called for Americans to evacuate 50 miles away. So, you know, that'd be a lot more people if the Japanese government were to do that, too. And, you know, truth be told, the U.S. military warned its people in places like Yokohama, which is some 200-plus miles to the southwest of Fukushima Daiichi, to shelter in place. So this is a much bigger catastrophe than governments will let on.
Well, where are these nuclear refugees? Where were they sent?
Well, that mayor who I'm referring to, the mayor of Futaba, who's now an outspoken anti-nuclear voice, their entire town of Futaba was relocated to an abandoned school in the Tokyo suburbs. So they've been living in very small physical space for now over 3 years. And some of these centers, which can only accommodate so many people per center, the space allotted to each individual or each family is just, you know, torturously small. And some of these folks are elderly, have other physical problems. And in fact, the Japanese press is not shy about reporting on indirect deaths attributable to Fukushima Daiichi, and the number is well over 1,500. A lot of them are elderly people or people who are sick. The stress of the evacuation has just been too much for them to survive. And of course, in addition to that, there are a large number of suicides as well.
We're talking with Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, and the point of this discussion is to get to an update here. This particular part of our discussion is to update all you listeners on what's happening at Fukushima now. And Kevin, you spoke in Fukushima. I was not in Fukushima, but I was in Japan September of 1975 to January of 1976, and then I went back in 78. Amy and I marched against nuclear power in Japan, and I wrote an article in the Progressive magazine that appeared in 1977 that talked a lot about Fukushima. So people are saying, "What in God's name are you doing? Building six reactors, actually 10, there's four more at Fukushima Daiichi, correct? Or is there six more?"
Four more, and yeah, I stood halfway between them on this bluff looking out over the Pacific to the east, and it was incredible how close they are. They're only 7 miles apart, and when you're right between them, it looks like you can reach out and touch the six at Daiichi and the four at Daiichi. And Daiichi only survived the catastrophe by a single off-site power line. They lost, I believe it was four off-site power lines to the earthquake, and the tsunami was actually bigger at Daiichi than it was at Daiichi. They lost all their diesels. And so if that one power line had gone down as well, it would have been more than twice as bad because there were four operating reactors at Daiichi that day.
Wow. And there were two at Fukushima Daiichi escaped, numbers five and six. And, you know, it's hard for me. Some of the things that the nuclear industry does, it's just actually hard to enunciate. So I'll let you do it, Kevin. Tell our listeners what happened to the 85-foot high bluff that they could have built these reactors on at Fukushima Daiichi.
Well, it was removed, and it was...
Yeah, it was, there you go. It was removed.
It was removed to make the pumping of seawater easier and less expensive for cooling purposes, because when you got six reactors at one site and then another four, you know, just 7 miles south, that's a lot of heat to get rid of. And in fact, an atomic reactor has to discharge two-thirds of its heat that it generates from splitting atoms as waste. And so if you do not build cooling towers to save yourself money, which is what they did at Daiichi and Daiichi, they would take advantage of the ocean and just dump the heat in the ocean. But to get down to the ocean and make that pumping of the water for cooling purposes easier, they simply removed their natural tsunami protection.
And what would have happened at Fukushima Daiichi in the tidal wave, in the tsunami, if the reactors had been put on top of the 85-foot bluff instead of the geniuses who built these reactors from General Electric and from Tokyo Electric Power? Instead of having removed it, what would have happened if the reactors were up 85 feet in the air?
Well, we don't know exactly if it would have survived that, because the seawater pumps on, you know, which would have been at sea level down at the ocean side, may have been destroyed. In fact, they were destroyed by this catastrophe. So Arne Gunderson with Fairwinds Associates points out that it's not just the loss of the diesels, it's not just the loss of the electricity, it's also the loss of the seawater pumps, because the ocean is the ultimate heat sink. So you're right, you know, they would have been in a better position for sure, but they may have lost their ultimate heat sink, even if they were still up on that bluff.
That's amazing to hear. We're joined now by Paul Gunter, Kevin Camps' cohort, co-conspirator at Beyond Nuclear. Paul, are you there?
Yeah, I am now.
Hi, Paul.
I was on mute.
Okay, so Paul, we're starting here with Fukushima, naturally enough, and you've heard most of what Kevin has said. Have you been? You haven't been to Japan, have you? To see these places?
I've been to Japan twice. Originally there with the Japanese on invitation by the Japanese Bar Association to talk about improved regulation. And I wanted to caution them not to make the example of their regulator, like the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which both countries continue to be part of this nuclear regulatory capture. You know, what I did want to mention really quick, though, you know, we're seeing news accounts right now that Fukushima Daiichi Unit 5 has a coolant leak to the spent fuel pool. And the temperatures, as a result of the leak, they've shut the cooling off to the spent fuel pool there at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 5. This is one of the, these are the two units that were not affected, 5 and 6, by the earthquake and tsunami. They were able to maintain power and cooling and without core damage. And but now we're seeing problems starting to crop up. This occurred, this was reported yesterday. Yesterday in Japan, that they are having problems with Unit 5 now.
That's amazing. Now, well, we should explain. Unit 5 and 6 were up a little higher, and they were they on when the tsunami hit on 3/11/11?
I don't believe that they were operating.
Right.
Only
units
I don't
one,
think they
two,
were either.
Were operating.
Unit 4 was not operating, but Unit 4 suffered a hydrogen explosion, which may have been from hydrogen leaking in from Unit 3. We're not sure.
Yeah.
But Units 5 and 6 are somewhat separate from Units 1, 2, 3, and 4 at Fukushima Daiichi. And so allegedly we thought they were in the clear. Now you're telling us there's a leak in the spent fuel pool. Tell us, both you and Kevin, Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps, what can happen if they lose coolant in one of these spent fuel pools, which is certainly still an issue very much so at Units 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Okay. Well, the cooling water is in there not only as radiation shielding for the workers who are in close, otherwise they would get a fatal dose of gamma radiation off of the waste that's in the pool. It's also there for thermal cooling. And if you lose the cooling water completely, let's say there's a sudden drain down, if a big earthquake were to hit Fukushima Daiichi again now and drop the bottom out of the pool at Unit 4, let's say, you could lose...
Now, when you say something like Kevin, you're supposed to say, God forbid.
Yes, so God forbid.
Say God forbid, please.
Exactly. You could have a fire with the waste within a matter of hours at the most. The waste would heat up to the ignition temperature of the zirconium metal cladding on the fuel rods, and the fire, depending on how much radioactive waste is in the pool, would perhaps release 100% of its radioactive cesium content, which is very volatile, which would then escape with the smoke and then fall out over a vast region. And that radioactive release could dwarf what's happened at Fukushima Daiichi thus far. I mean, you had the three meltdowns, the multiple explosions, damage or destruction of reactor containment structures, and that's where the radioactivity got out from, according to the official version of things. If one of these pools were to go up in flames, you could dwarf the radioactivity that's been released thus far in the last 3.5 years because there's so much radioactivity in the pools.
Somebody, by the way, is breathing into the cell phone, so I don't think it's me, but just be a little careful on that, if you would. Paul, you were about to jump in?
I was just going to say, I do want to just make one thing clear, that we're not seeing a rapid rise of the temperature in the fuel pool at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 5. This is a loss of cooling to the system through a flow valve that provides the cooling water to the fuel pool, and so there's about a 3-millimeter hole where the leak is occurring, and so there, they have shut down the cooling system to try to get at repairing that leak, but we're still now monitoring a temperature rise that, according to RT Network, you know, they've got a 9-day margin, but to restore cooling and to make up water, and I don't want to hit the panic button with this, but I'm bringing this up as for the purpose of that we're going to continue to see problems after problem after problem crop up at not only the four units that were destroyed, but you know, the fact that there are site restrictions, the country is still trying to recover from the catastrophe. These problems are going to be recurring at that site, and similar problems are likely to crop up at the other reactors, even as they are shut down. These are not passive systems. This is not a passive technology. It has to be monitored. It has to be safeguarded against, even when you shut these things down.
Okay, let's point out that we're talking with Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, two of the stalwarts of the movement for safe energy and to shut nuclear reactors. Both have been in Japan. I've been to Japan twice, but long before most of you listening in were born, I was there in 76 and then again in 78. I wanted to point out two things here. First of all, there is one and only one good thing that has come from the Fukushima disaster, and that is that the other 48 reactors in Japan remain shut, and that is a tribute to the power of the anti-nuclear movement and the public in Japan, because there is now, and where you really have to increasingly describe it as an outright fascist regime in Tokyo, the Shinzo Abe regime. They are militarizing, they are killing whales, they're doing whatever you would expect from a nightmare takeover by corporations in Japan. And the other thing is that that we need to discuss as we get a little further here is that these problems with the spent fuel pools at Fukushima, Daiichi, are replicable at all the 440-some reactors worldwide, including the 100 still operating here in the United States, although we're about to go down to 99. I assume Vermont Yankee is still operating, but will shut shortly. So how can they actually stop the cooling system at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 5? What will happen to the fuel? You said they have an eight-day window. Is that right, Paul?
I think we're probably on the order of an eight-day window now, but originally reported at nine. These things, it really depends on when the nuclear fuel is offloaded into these so-called spent fuel pools. They're really irradiated, high-level nuclear waste storage ponds. In this case, at the Fukushima Daiichi facilities, these pools, again, are 6 to 10 stories up, and they're literally in the attic of the reactor, up on the top, and not in any kind of containment structure. So they're very vulnerable.
Do we know the name of the genius that thought that up? Who is it that decided?
General Electric.
Yes, General Melvin Electric.
Yes.
Decided to put these things 100 feet in the air.
On the roof.
I'm sure he'll get the Nobel Prize for that one.
So if you have just offloaded the reactor core, as was the case for Unit 4 at Fukushima Daiichi, then you have a shorter span of time for, you know, in fact, a matter of hours to a few days to manage the heat load from that extremely thermally hot and highly radioactive fuel that's just come out of the reactor and put into these cooling ponds. So you're on a much shorter nuclear fuse, if you would, in the event of a loss of cooling, loss of ability to make up water. We don't have any backup power systems, particularly for these earlier reactors like the GE Mark I, Mark II. And the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has actually refused our petitions to try to have emergency backup power on these very vulnerable pools, where you could start up systems from emergency diesel generators there at the site to restore cooling circulation to, you know, with pumps and motors, but they've absolutely refused to do that. They instead are now relying upon, you know, stretching out fire hoses from around the plant and then pumping water back in to make up the water that will evaporate, and particularly as these pools heat up to boiling points, where you then begin to get tremendous amounts of steam that then can condense and have unintended consequences by electrical shorts of other in other equipment as this shower of condensed steam begins to work its way through the reactor. So, I mean, there's a big range, but according to
There's a big range of things can go wrong, and these idiots at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Big range of what can go wrong, and there's actually a range over the time at which it can occur. So if you've had fuel in the storage ponds as they've had at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 5, you've got more time because that fuel has had years to cool. So that's, why we're seeing, a much wider window at which they can, they're looking to try to recover cooling to the Unit 5 spent fuel pool.
And another thing to point out, an important difference between the U.S. and Japan is the U.S. pools are much more packed with high-level radioactive waste than those at Fukushima Daiichi. So one example that comes to mind is a GE Mark I here in the U.S. at the Fermi Unit 2 in southeast Michigan. And Michael Keegan, who's the watchdog up there with Don't Waste Michigan, got his hands on the document from Detroit Edison, which documented that if they lose the electric grid there, the pool, given how much waste is in there, and it's over 600 tons at this point, and Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, which was the worst of the units over there, had just over a couple hundred. So it's like three times the amount of waste in Fermi Unit 2. That within 4 hours, and I think it's 4 hours and 18 minutes, that pool is going to be at the boiling point. And you may still have, as Paul was saying, a longer fuse until catastrophe. You may have several days or even a week, perhaps, or 2 weeks even, in some cases, before you boil the water all the way down to the top of the fuel rods. But once you start to approach the fuel rods with just a little bit of water on top, the radiation dose rates in the pool area are going to be fatal instantly. So people can't get in there, you can't drop a hose over the edge anymore, and the NRC is really kind of blasé about all these situations. They talk a good line, they've got all these flex systems in place that they will deploy when needed. If you don't deploy quickly enough, and a real-world example is Fukushima Daiichi, where the pools were actually of lesser crisis priority because the reactors were melting, they later admitted. If you don't act quickly enough on the pools, then, you're going to have real problems.
So the bottom line here is that Fukushima is in no way, shape, or form finished. Crosby, Stills, Nash just issued a new – Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, I guess, just issued a new album of one of their tours, which was apparently a total nightmare of a tour. And David Crosby told me that he wanted to call the album What Could Go Wrong? So that's our theme here at Fukushima. We still have the spent fuel pool unit 4 in the air where there was an explosion, and they're trying to bring down the fuel from unit 4. This got a lot of attention about a year ago. Tell us, Paul and Kevin, what is happening with the bring down of the spent fuel from unit 4's fuel pool, which is 100 feet in the air?
Well, Tokyo Electric claims that they are 75% of the way through that process. I just was checking out their press release from last week about it. But they are taking many months off. I think it was until September, if I'm not mistaken. They're going to take 3 months off to inspect their crane, which makes no sense. That's a very long inspection. They call it an annual inspection that lasts 3 months. So there are still some, I think it's 200 assemblies of irradiated fuel in that pool. That's the real thing to worry about. There's another certain number of fresh fuel assemblies, not irradiated, that are in there as well. And I just have to wonder if this fraction of the fuel that they appear to be letting stay in there for another several months is damaged or deformed in some way from all of the forces it was exposed to, the earthquake, the tsunami, the explosion, whatever else has happened to it. And Arne Gundersen warned many months ago that they were going to run into problems. They, for one thing, on March 17th, 6 days into the catastrophe,
March
they were dropping
2011.
Water, seawater from helicopter. So that seawater could have corroded the fuel in the Unit 4 pool. Maybe that's what they've run into now is corroded fuel.
Well, I believe actually, and I, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there were three fuel rods or assemblies, I don't remember which, that were damaged before the tsunami, that they were already considered problematic and they didn't know how they were going to get them out.
Okay.
And so what you're saying now, I may be wrong about that, but what you're saying now is that that Tokyo Electric Power has removed a large percentage of the fuel rods, fuel assemblies at Unit 4, but they're now stopping. And telling us that they're just taking a short break here, 3 months.
Yeah.
That sounds a little suspicious to me.
Yeah,
and I'm sure,
you know,
it sounds
especially given Arne's warnings about, you know, the deformed or the damaged fuel could be very difficult, if not impossible, because if it's stuck in its fuel channel, they would have to exert a lot of force to get it out, which may be just enough to shatter corroded fuel. And then you've got a real mess on your hands, for one thing. And another thing that really we should hasten to add is that Unit 3's high-level radioactive waste storage pool status is largely unknown, although there have been some very shocking photographs released by Tokyo Electric and some video that show that that pool is just filled to the top with debris. I mean, it's obvious that there's water in there, but that's about all you can say because it's so full of debris, including a 30-ton crane that fell in there after the explosion. We just don't know the status of that fuel. What kind
you're
of damage
saying,
it's
You're
had.
Saying at Unit 3 at Fukushima Daiichi, a 30-ton crane fell into the spent fuel pool?
That and a lot more, because the pool appears to be full of debris. And if you look at that dramatic video of the explosion at Unit 3, and you look at the dark spots on the top of that mushroom-shaped cloud, that is the reactor building. That is walls of concrete that were blown way up in the sky and then rained back down, and a lot of it falling back into the pool.
That's unbelievable. You know, it's amazing to me that none of this has been in any corporate media, not on CNN, not on MSNBC, certainly not on Fox, ABC, NBC. You know, the only a major news outlet that I've followed that's covered any of this stuff at all has been Reuters. I mean, have you seen any reports of this anywhere in the major media?
The Japanese media, Asahi Shimbun, has almost daily coverage of Fukushima Daiichi, so that's where I try to get a lot of information.
Okay, we're talking with Kevin Kampson, Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. It's beyondnuclear.org, is that correct?
Right.
Okay, and so, Unit 3, which you just described, a spent fuel pool full of debris, that is also the one that had the mixed oxide uranium fuel that had plutonium in it. Is that not correct?
Yeah, it was a 6% core. They were heading towards a 33% core, but they hadn't gotten there yet. They loaded the first plutonium MOX in September of 2011. And in fact, the speaking tour that took me to Japan, that was organized by Green Action, Eileen Miyoko Smith, was a last gasp effort to stop the loading of plutonium MOX. But at Fukushima Daiichi Unit Number 3, they loaded it just the next month after I was there. So they did have a 6% plutonium MOX core that was heading towards 33%. Before that,
and we have to say at this point that it was only Citizen Action, your group, other groups in the United States, Irene Miyoko Smith, and people in Japan who prevented an even higher percentage of plutonium from being in that core that did blow up. And that people who have seen that explosion and people looking in, I urge you to go online and look at the explosion at Fukushima Unit 4. It's the one, Unit 3, I'm sorry, it's the one that does look like it could be fission. It could be a nuclear explosion. Is that right?
Well, Arne Gundersen has theorized that it was a prompt criticality, and he admits that he's in a minority opinion in the scientific community, but it certainly was a larger scale explosion than the others, and he also has to wonder if the explosion was centered in the pool, which would raise all kinds of other issues in terms of the status of that pool. And you know, there's a question, and Paul can speak to this for sure, about the fragments of fuel that have been documented, in some cases kilometers away from the nuclear power plant site. Where did those come from? Did those come from an explosion in a pool? And Paul witnessed another version of what could have accounted for that.
All right, well, we're gonna have to take a short break now, both for technical reasons and emotionally. When we come back, we've been talking with Kevin Camps and Paul Gunter from the Beyond Nuclear Organization. Paul is, and we'll talk more now about where the plutonium might have gone. I know that it has been detected around the countryside in Japan, so we'll have a short break with Dana Lyons singing the Rocky Top Solartopia song, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Home sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home and under.
Yeah, Solartopia for you and me. That's Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame. Over 2 million visits on the Cows with Guns website. Take a look at it, especially all you vegan, vegetarian types out there like me. It's our anthem. We've been talking with Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps of BeyondNuclear.org. Great guys, and I've known them for decades. They're doing God's own work here, and we're going through the scenario here. You know, I'm sure the vast majority of the American people think everything at Fukushima is hunky-dory. As Pete would say, it's under control, blah, blah, blah. It is anything but under control. And, Paul, you were talking about, or we were talking about with Kevin, and you're going to jump in here about the plutonium that was released that involved at Unit 3, which had an explosion that looks like a nuclear explosion. Can you talk to us a bit about what's happening at Unit 3 and what we need to look at?
Well, one of the concerns that has always been there is what happened when these reactors exploded? What exactly was it? And clearly, there was hydrogen gas in all four units and their damage. But the big concern is that it's certainly in the case of the mushroom cloud that we saw at Unit 3, there was radioactive plutonium in the fallout, and I've seen I was actually at a meeting in June of 2011, so we're just months after the disaster began, where officials from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission were briefing the commission and the public there at the NRC headquarters. And what they revealed was that over 2 miles away from the Fukushima Daiichi reactor site, they were recovering fragments of fuel rods. And there had been some question as to whether or not these fuel fragments, these pieces, these little pieces of fuel rod, which are, you know, highly radioactive, had come from the spent fuel pool during those explosions. And the NRC officials confirmed that the radioactive signature on these fuel rods, these fuel fragments, particularly the iodine-131 signature, was that these were reactor core material. So the material that left those fuel fragments, that some inches long, were pieces of fuel from one of the reactor cores.
So wait. Now you said some of these pieces of plutonium waste material were inches long?
Yeah, one was about 2 inches long.
Wow.
And so they have found, they have been finding fuel fragments. We don't really know the extent, but part of the problem is there is this blackout of information, and it's an official blackout conducted by Tokyo Electric Power Company, who assumed full control over all operations there, and even to the point of where they control their oversight by the Japanese government, and then the blackout of a large blackout of the media. But there was this one, and this is part of an NRC transcript. I believe it's June 24, 2011. One of the beginning briefings that were public at the NRC headquarters, where it's documented that they identified fuel fragments. These are, plutonium fragments, but there's a whole host of radioactive materials in these fragments of fuel, including strontium-90, cesium-137, and many dozens more.
So we know these are from one of the reactors. What we're not clear on is whether they're from a fuel pool or from an actual core. And
that the NRC identified and has documented by transcript that the fuel fragment that they saw, the radioactive signature indicated it was from a reactor core.
So after decades, and I mean decades, of being told you and I, Paul, are older than God, and so we're obviously at least in this movement, you and I both remember decades of being told by a very indignant nuclear power industry that a reactor cannot explode, we are now being told that actually a core of a reactor has blown. How far away?
The transcript identifies that it was on the order of, under 2 miles.
Or more than 1 mile.
More than 1 mile.
Away from more than a mile away.
Beyond the fence line of Fukushima Daiichi, they're finding fuel fragments from a reactor core.
That's
what the transcript says.
That's terrifying. I mean, now all these reactors are General Electric reactors. How many reactors are there in the United States similar to the ones at Fukushima Daiichi and Daini?
Virtually identical. We have 21 General Electric, 23 General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors that are similar to units 1 through 5. Unit 6 is a GE... a Mark II boiling water reactor. So we've got 8 of those. So, of the 35, we have the majority of the Mark I, Mark II reactors in the world. Many of these reactors circling cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, upstate New York, they're all along the Great Lakes. So these are essentially the they're prototypes. You know, they commercialized these Mark I reactors in particular with without fully testing them. So the experiments are now encircling some of our largest population centers.
Well, that's reassuring. So we have 23 Mark I's, 8 Mark II's, and the only difference between our reactors and the ones in Japan is that the ones in Japan are shut, thankfully.
Correct.
And our schools are much more filled with radioactive waste.
Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear, you follow this pretty closely. How do you see this playing out in Japan in terms of the struggle to keep these 48 reactors? There were 54 operating reactors in Japan on March 11th, 2011. The earthquake tsunami took out 6 at Fukushima Daiichi. And now the public, they gradually shut down. 2 were reopened and have since shut down. So now we have 48 shut reactors in Japan. The fascist regime, the Abe regime, is trying to reopen them. How do you see this playing out politically in Japan?
Was that to me, Harvey? Or
go ahead. You can
close you. Okay. Close you, please.
I am able to stay until the end, just to let you know.
Good.
Well, it's,
glad to have you
both. Nothing short of a miracle that the Japanese anti-nuclear movement, environmental movement, and just civic society, a majority of the population of Japan, have not allowed the reactors to be turned back on for the most part. And like you said, there were a couple at OE in western Japan that turned on for a short few months back in 2012, I think it was, and then they came down again. And there were some that were operating, on March 11th and kept operating for a while after that. But there's been a tradition of turning to the local prefecture, asking the governor for permission to restart reactors, as well as mayors of the towns that host them.
Well, after March 11th, 2011,
everything had changed because
that's a novel concept, isn't it? I mean, in the United States, the governor and the mayor, the local communities have no say whatsoever in whether these reactors are.
You're right. It's very different here, but it was very pro forma in Japan. I mean, it sounds good, but they always said yes until this catastrophe happened. And they realized that they'd been lied to. And it's still a monumental tug of war between, as you said, the Abe Liberal Democratic Party and the rest of the country, pretty much. The industry.
Well, you know,
I
was in Japan we've all been in Japan. The Liberal Democratic Party, the joke about the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan is that it's not liberal, it's certainly not democratic, and it darn sure isn't a party. But it is, the regime that's in charge now, Shinzo Abe. And you're saying that the local people have been able, up to this point, they're the ones who've been resisting successfully the reopening of these reactors?
Well, you've had, rallies of 250,000 people at the prime minister's residence back in 2012, which is unprecedented in Japanese history, really. On this or any other environmental issue, but on any issue, really, going back decades, there were labor rallies in the 50s and 60s. And one piece of history that's really fascinating to me is when there was tremendous uproar in Japan over fallout from U.S. hydrogen bomb testing in the South Pacific, there was a similar groundswell of opposition in Japan against hydrogen bomb testing. This was less than a decade after World War II. Not many years since the U.S. occupation ended, people were not standing for it. You had petitions with millions of signatures, a million signatures from Hiroshima alone back in the 1950s. And what I'm getting at is the founding of the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan in 1954, 1955, one of its central planks was pro-nuclear power. And this actually came straight from the Eisenhower administration and the Central Intelligence Agency, who were sent to Japan to sell Atoms for Peace to try to tamp down these anti-nuclear protests in Japan, really kind of through bribery. You know, we're going to give you this technology, and then the Japanese industry picked up on the bribery theme, and they would bribe local communities and say, we will build you a town hall, we will build you a baseball stadium, we will give you all these tax revenues, all you have to do is say yes. And so those restart decisions in the past were automatic, and that's not the case anymore by any means.
Harvey.
Paul Gunter, go ahead.
The big concern now is where you have the local resistance mounting. we now are seeing changes. It's this same entrenchment of the nuclear industry in the government. Most recently, this was documented where an incoming a new commissioner for the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority, it was identified by an investigative report through this newspaper that all of us really should be following, Asahi Shimbun, where they discovered that he's been taking payments from the nuclear industry up until the last month before he got his appointment to the to be the new commissioner. So this new commissioner, Satoru Tanaka, professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Tokyo, has been receiving unknown amounts of money from Japan Nuclear Fuel Limited and from Mitsubishi FBR Systems, a nuclear plant maker. So we're seeing, you know, the Japanese Diet, their Congress, in a report that came out following the disaster, they identified that Fukushima Daiichi was not a natural event. It was a man-made disaster, they identified, and it was a disaster that was made by the collusion of government, regulator, and Tokyo Electric Power Company. And, you know, they basically set about a reform movement on the oversight of nuclear power. But now, these latest investigations are confirming that the industry, even shut down, remains entrenched in the Japanese government. And that's
so
really
nothing like that, of course,
here.
Can happen here in the United States. We have totally independent regulators who are in no way, shape, or form influenced by the nuclear power industry. We'll never go to work for a nuclear corporation. Isn't that right, Kevin and Paul? Can you tell us a little bit about the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission and its relations with the industry that it's supposed to regulate?
Well, a really stark example of our own collusion here in the United States is William Magwood IV, who is currently serving as an NRC commissioner. He's been on there since 2010. And a coalition of 100 environmental groups, anti-nuclear groups, public interest groups got together in 2009, even before the nomination was official, and wrote to President Obama and said, just don't do this, because Magwood was in industry. He actually served for a time as a consultant to Tokyo Electric Power Company long before the catastrophe. Then he went to the Department of Energy, where he was in charge of promoting nuclear power, which is the mandate of the Office of Nuclear Energy at DOE. He served there for the better part of a decade. And then all of a sudden, he's going to be a nuclear safety regulator. And we said, hold on, you can't do a 180 like that in your career. You can't go from promotion to regulation. You're blurring the lines, just like it used to be back at the Atomic Energy Commission back in the 50s and 60s, and it was finally dismantled
right,
in the 70s.
It still is, and I want to point out, it still is that way at the International Atomic Energy Agency at the United Nations. And
well,
go ahead,
Magwood
go ahead,
is back in trouble again. He is now the recipient of a letter from a coalition of dozens of environmental groups, including ours, saying you need to recuse yourself immediately, and in fact, just resign your commission seat, because he took a job several months ago as Nuclear Energy Agency Director General. This is Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. The Nuclear Energy Agency is based in Paris, and just like you said, Harvey, about the IAEA at the UN, the NEA in Paris is a promotional institution. They promote nuclear power. So here is Magwood, still at the safety regulator in the U.S. How is he going to vote on all these critical safety votes before him, if not for the industry he's about to go work for? He's going to make his job more difficult in the future by voting for safety now, and so he's been called upon to resign his position.
Oh, and also take the example of former NRC Chairman Dale Klein, who, following his end of term as U.S. NRC Commissioner, and then the following the advent of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident, Dale Klein is now the chair for the Tokyo Electric Power Company Restart Committee. So we continually, you can see example after example of a revolving door between industry and regulators, supposedly. But if anything, what we're talking about being regular is that they are promoters rather than safety regulators.
And what are the implications? Let's talk about lessons that we should have learned from Fukushima and implementation of changes in American reactors. As you've pointed out, there are 23 General Electric Mark I's in the United States, 8 General Electric Mark II's. And what happened at Fukushima Daiichi could happen to any one of them. What has changed in the requirements for operating American reactors since Fukushima, March 11th, 2011?
If anything, the change is that they just want to protect the finance. You know, they're more focused on protecting the financial agenda of these power companies as these plants get older and would require more maintenance or require more backfits following a nuclear accident like Fukushima. Just really quickly, let's look at what's happening in Japan in an effort to restart these shutdown reactors. Hitachi GE, which is the Japan-based corporation, merged in a contract deal with Areva in France to bolster public confidence by installing filtered containment vents on these very vulnerable boiling water reactor structures so that they could say we have more safety. You come over here to the United States, and GE Hitachi, which is the American-based corporation, is basically refused to install the same kind of enhanced safety backfit by putting filters on vents on these very vulnerable Mark I, Mark II reactors.
And these filters really aren't all that expensive. It's not that big a deal to do it. And so the Japanese are willing to do it, and the Americans are not. We're down to the last 5 minutes here with Paul Gunter and Kevin Camps. Listen, guys, I'd like you to come back in 2 weeks. We barely scratched the surface, if you can.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Good.
Can't get this stuff out through the corporate media. They're not interested. They don't understand it. It requires thought, and it requires going up against the corporation. So if you will kindly resend the URL, I will send out, this will be posted and archived within 24 hours or less. If you will take the URL and put it up on your Facebook sites and through your emails and on your websites. It's the only way you can get the word out. Tom Hartman has Paul on from time to time, and Kevin, you get on some of the media, but none of this information, certainly not in a 1 hour show, is being covered anywhere that I know of. And this is, of course, a life and death for our whole planet. So I'm having Araya the vegan on next weekend week after that, 2 weeks from today, if you'll come back. We haven't even gotten to the health issues, for God's sakes, and we need to do that. So tell us, we're down to our last 3 minutes here. How worried do we need to be about the American reactors here? And since we've been focused on Japan, what are the chances that they're going to keep all the reactors shut in Japan, all 48? Where do we stand on that right now?
Well, I just got an email from Eileen Miyoko Smith at Green Action in Kyoto, and she expressed yet again their, you know, adamant desire to keep the reactors shut, and they will work day and night to do so. So they're giving it their all. They're up against a very powerful economic and political force, the Japanese and international nuclear industry.
But we stand with 70% of the Japanese public to keep Japan zero nuclear.
It's amazing that it's happened. I mean, as I say, the one good thing that's happened comes from Fukushima is 48 reactors is well over 10% of the global total. And so thank God for that much. Thank the Japanese people for that much. Where do we stand in the United States? How are we shut four last year. Vermont Yankee's about to go down. How are we looking for shutdowns here?
Well, that's a whole other program.
Well, that's what
Exelon
we'll do in 2 weeks.
Nuclear,
we'll start with that.
Exelon Nuclear, they're looking at five or six reactors shut down at the end of this year. But, you know, because Exelon is President Obama's nuclear utility, the Obama administration has introduced rulemakings through the Environmental Protection Agency to protect these old and deteriorating reactors from shutting down. So we, you know, we actually have a fight on right now where the EPA is looking to replace renewable portfolio standards with what they call clean energy to bring nuclear and clean coal back online.
Right, two of the great oxymorons in American history, safe nukes and clean coal. Paul and Kevin, it's always an honor to talk to you two guys. I'm glad you're not in jail right now. Glad we're none of us are in jail right now. But this is serious, serious stuff. So in 2 weeks, we will resume our conversation. We'll start with the health impacts of Fukushima. We'll know more. As you know, I've put out a piece based on the work of Joe Mangano and the Fukushima Medical University indicating that there is a 40 times normal cancer rate in the thyroids of the children around Fukushima Daiichi, and it's only going to get worse. And we've also seen new information about the health impacts at reactors that are operating. And we will talk development you've mentioned here about pushing to keep these old reactors shut in the United States. These are precisely the reactors that are the most dangerous and the most likely to give us a Fukushima here in the United States, and these are the ones they're fighting to keep open. So at least we're sure that Vermont Yankee is going to go down, and we'll talk in 2 weeks about more of that. Last word real quickly from both of you.
No nukes.
Yeah, you know, five shutdowns in the U.S. and one in Quebec. It's a record, so we need to break that record in the next year.
Yeah, we really got to accelerate this, and we'll see you in Solartopia, both you guys, 2 weeks from now. Thanks so much, Kevin Camps, Paul Gunter from beyondnuclear.org. Folks, please do send the URL for this show around. It's the only way we can get the word around. Put it on Facebook, on your websites, via email, and however else it goes. Twitter, too. I forgot about Twitter. And even, what's that other one? LinkedIn. I've started to use LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening in, all of you, and for spreading this around. We'll be back next week with Araya Flynn, the vegan, and 2 weeks we'll be back with Paul and Kevin. No nukes out there, and we'll see you in Solartopia.